This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, topic of the day, racially offensive speech and behavior. This was brought to the fore by recent events in Virginia. The governor of Virginia was caught in an old picture where he was either in blackface or in a Klan robe. And there has been a big ruckus about this. A lot of calls for his resignation. Our guest today, Neil Lester, is a professor of English at ASU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And Steve Lemons is a Phoenix-based journalist, written many years for the New Times, now has written for a number of other national and other publications. Welcome also, first-timer. Oh,
thanks for having me.
Read your stuff for many years. Well, I was going to start out with a presumption and say that started like this. It said, well, you know, blackface, well, people understand why that's offensive. But then I read a poll. 39% of the public in a recent poll said they don't see what's the problem. So, Dr. Lester, I think we got to start from square one. What's the problem with blackface?
Well, in order to talk about what the problem is, and I would only clarify a little bit that offensive may not be the word that I would use when I describe blackface. I would say problematic, because okay, there are things that can be problematic without being offensive. There are a lot of things that people can do that I don't have to be personally offended by. Mm-hmm. And part of that use of offensive can be when people talk about people being so fragile that people
of the objections from that, somewhere in that 39%, is people are saying, oh, what's the big deal?
Yes, stop being so offensive. Right.
Right.
And so what I would say is it's racially problematic. And in order to understand that it's racially problematic, you certainly have to understand its history. And I think that's what's missing from the conversation, is that this really isn't just about what happened with the governor, but the fact that there's a long tradition and a history of dehumanizing certain groups of people, in this case, black people. And that's one mechanism through which that was done. So it's not so much, oh, it's just a costume, but it's a whole attitude that goes with a whole group of people that continues to be dehumanized and disenfranchised because of unthoughtful or uncritical behavior by white people.
Some of whom may not get the history, too. In other words, it can be by people who are not trying to be offensive.
Well, that's why I don't go up with this word offensive.
Okay.
And I think we have
problematic seems like such a mild word. I'm kind of surprised by your usage.
I'm less interested in using labels for people than talking about their behavior, because there is a potential for transformation. Mm-hmm. In this case, you know, people have talked about, oh, the governor says that he's evolved. My own opinion is that he can evolve on his own time and not necessarily as the governor of the state. And then sometimes people don't evolve. And what's more interesting to me about that case is the fact that some of the other stuff that he said about Michael Jackson is equally problematic. And he still didn't seem to sort of understand the gravity and his own white privilege in talking about that episode that happened several years ago. Not to mention the fact that there are all these things that are perhaps misrepresented when he first said that it wasn't him, or he did apologize.
Oh, yeah. Story was a little
There's all kinds of stuff.
There's some sketchiness to the story.
That make that problematic. Yeah, yeah. So, but personally, I'm not offended by it.
The Michael Jackson thing, I'm wondering, I mean, he said that he wore black, well, he didn't characterize it as blackface. He said, I put some shoe polish on my cheeks.
That, by definition, becomes, unless you're on a football field and you're putting something under to get the glare, then you're doing blackface or brownface.
Yeah.
So, and that's what the issue is. And rather than accepting that maybe I stepped into some poo, maybe I should own this and then figure out how to get out of it. Well, it's clear to me from press conference was that he really didn't seem to understand why and how this was problematic. Mm-hmm. But that's the same thing with Megyn Kelly, who lost her job, you know, as a result of sort of apologizing for those who saw this as a costume. There's too much historical baggage there to be as cavalier about it and to somehow not own it and also acknowledge a certain kind of ignorance of our American history. Mm-hmm. This is not just African-American history, it's American history. And if we don't understand, for example, that that tradition started in the late 1800s and lasted through the early 1900s and was clearly about mocking and making of black people buffoons and coons, mm-hmm. that then you don't understand the history. And that's the baggage that it carries.
Let me
– not to mention the lynching. And the violence that's associated with it. So there's a whole lot of stuff wrapped up in that image.
But what's interesting to me about the governor is that his history, I mean, he himself went to an integrated high school. He was one of two white players on the basketball team. He attends predominantly a black church. His pastor is African American, and so it's like it's sort of befuddling to me on what, like, how could he not understand how serious this is, you know, and how could he keep stepping in it? On the other hand, I don't, and actually, as far as like policy wise, he's he really courted the African American vote when he got elected. He won, I think it was like 60-70%. Maybe that's, you know, because he is a Democrat. I don't know, but he did actively court that vote. So and his policies reflect that, you know, as a, you know, and so in fairly you know, moderate to liberal Democrat. And that's the question I have is why. But then, you know, I mean, I know you taught in the South, and I'm from North Carolina originally.
And lived in the South.
Yeah, I lived in, exactly. Yeah, I've lived.
So I was living there before I started teaching.
Where did you go? Where did you go?
Georgia.
Oh, okay, I was from North. I grew up in North Carolina.
And then I was in Alabama.
And as you know, the culture. I mean, a lot of the culture is shared, obviously, between whites and blacks. But there is still like a great deal of segregation, even self-segregation, and it's a complex. It didn't surprise me that he had done this, you know, in his past. What surprised me is how badly he handled it. And I thought, like, you know, well, you know, first it was like he kind of tried to own it. And I thought that was probably the best way to handle it if you're going to try to survive politically. Then he kind of backtracked and had this other, you know, explanation, which you're right, didn't make any sense. But, you know, it's interesting. The 58% the poll I saw that CBS had done was like 58% of African Americans are willing to give the guy another chance. Mm-hmm. I think that says a lot about. You know, I think it says a lot about the South too, about people willing to try to get along.
Was that national or was that Virginia?
That was Virginia. Yeah, it was in Virginia.
Well, keep in mind also that, you know, groups are not monolithic or homogeneous.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to expect that the scenario you presented earlier can't coexist.
Right.
He can still have black friends. He can still go to black churches.
Right.
And still do racially problematic behavior.
Oh, absolutely.
Those things are not mutually exclusive.
Absolutely.
The other thing is that I'm not surprised that some blacks would do that. There are some black people who dress in blackface. In fact, we had two episodes at Arizona State a few years ago where the person who decided that it was Spirit Day and we're going to dress in black was the one who initiated blackface.
Hmm.
So some of those black people could probably stand to sit in my class a session or two also.
But don't you think it has – I mean, also it's – there's a – I mean, religion plays a big part in the South and – people, it's like there's sort of this Christian thing. I'm not
asking for forgiveness.
Yeah, I mean, I'm agnostic to atheist, so I don't really care. But I do recognize that that's like a thing there, and people are kind of like, okay, we'll give the guy. A lot of people are forgiving. In general, the American public is forgiving if you make a mistake. And of course, this one was one he made like 40 years ago.
Right.
The problem, I think, really is. You're right. His inability to understand why this was such a huge deal, you know, and I think he should have continued to own it if he wanted to try to stay, I don't think it's impossible that he could have survived or can survive. I mean, he's still in office. So.
Well, he also said that
we'll pick this up in just a minute. We'll be back in the think tank, continuing our discussion.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
I've been corrected. We're going to talk about racially problematic behavior. Some would have used the word offensive, but I find that a very interesting characterization, and I think it's really quite brilliant. You say offensive, it's conversation ending.
Well, I think if you attach a label to it, here's where the offensive part comes in, is because people talk about snowflakes, and they talk about how easily people are like peaches to be bruised. Mm-hmm. And I'm less interested in being offended by the governor's performance than anybody else's. It's problematic, and he doesn't get it.
Okay, and I can think, therefore, being in a situation where, in all innocence, I make a statement that is perhaps clueless,
right?
But there's no ill intent in my heart, and somebody comes at me and says that's offensive. Oh. Mm-hmm. My gut reaction is to build up a wall and say, "No, it isn't," you know.
Or I didn't mean that,
right? And that wasn't what I meant. Which can be true. You say it's problematic. I think that's not conversation. Well, what's that sort of problematic begets a question that says,
"What's why problematic
is
about it?
Why that's is that right. problematic?" Educate me.
That's right.
Back to the subject of Virginia and the governor, I want to throw out a proposition. In a lot of these cases, we get to, okay, this is a problematic statement. We should have a discussion. But if the governor resigns, in all likelihood, that's the end of the discussion. Because a lot of people then say, well, we fixed the problem. I wonder if that's an argument for non-resignation, especially on the part of a fella who has, I think most people agree, a decent public record. Now, discount now what he did 35 years ago in medical school, but his public record, his public statements, I have not heard anybody say that there has been anything particularly problematic about his public record. Yes, his initial attempt to kind of tap dance around the way he treated it was awkward, but I didn't think it was venal. It was awkward. It was hard to – some of it – the initial explanation in relation to the second one was a little hard to swallow, but –
But this is this situation. I mean, in some way, it can obviously, since we have the professor here, it can be a teaching moment, obviously. But you know, this is kind of in the same way that the debate over Confederate war memorials and so forth has kind of ripped open a sore that was there, and you know, for a long time, there's ripped the sore off of it. And sort of exposed it. There are more cases of people having politicians having done blackface when they were in college or something. The Attorney General of Virginia, obviously, he would be third in line, I think, in secession. He's also a Democrat. He's also considered to be fairly progressive. And so that's
the political complication. And yes, number two in line.
Yeah.
Is a lieutenant governor who's now had a second charge of rape. So, and number four in line is a Republican. So it ends up having a political dimension. I've noticed that initially there were all sorts of calls for the governor to resign. I haven't heard a lot of follow up on that since it holds forth the potential of a complete gutting of Democratic elected officials in the state of Virginia.
Well, and also there's the political reality, of course, if you're talking about something like redistricting, which would affect who's going to be your congressional representative, and that can be affected by who's the governor.
Right, except the governor would be reelected, I think, in 2019.
The governors in Virginia only serve one term.
Right.
Their term is up
in 2019.
They can run again, but they can't.
In other words, the
no
redistricting governor,
terms.
I think, is the next one, not this one.
Say again?
I think the redistricting governor is not the current one, but whoever's elected next.
I thought that he was, but maybe I'm wrong. I won't swear to that either.
I know they have off-year elections.
But my point is more to the policy. Okay, so let's say that he has policies that considered to be progressive in regards to race relations and other areas. So what if we, what if there's another person? I'm not saying the Republican necessarily would not have, positive race relations, but let's say the Republican who's fourth in line, the Speaker of the House there, would if that person has contrary, public policy, and is it a good thing for the people of Virginia? So I think it's
let me throw an additional complication. The Republican who is the Speaker of the House in Virginia is there as the result of a coin flip. The seat, there was one seat that was so contested at the end, they called it a draw, and they had a flip of the coin, and the Republican won the coin flip, and therefore they got a one vote majority in the House. And as, so the Speaker of the House, a Republican in Virginia, is there by virtue of a coin flip, not a vote of the people.
Well, here's what I'd like to sort of challenge, though, is this notion that the political party somehow explains one's views, one's attitudes, one's thinking on race, because that is problematic. I know people who are Republicans and who don't say things like that. They could be fiscally conservative. So
absolutely.
That's what we're trying to do,
absolutely.
Is not be reductive, so that we have labels. And just because somebody identifies as one thing doesn't necessarily mean that it automatically means something else.
I agree completely.
Yep.
Okay, we will continue this conversation in just a moment after the break in the Think Tank on KTAR.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are continuing our discussion on racially problematic speech and behavior. Our guests are Neil Lester, who's professor of English at ASU, and Stephen Lemons, local journalist. There was a fellow who I was going to bring in here, an old friend of mine who's been on the show a couple of times. Mike Altman's a former law professor at ASU, now retired. He wrote the following. And I want to just read what he wrote to me and then just throw it out for discussion. He said, if people are offended by something, those feelings are relevant, but the inquiry should not stop at the supposed offensive event. For example, it matters that the people of Virginia are offended by the governor or the AG's blackface 35 years ago. But it also matters what he says now. It matters whether or not he issues a sincere apology. And it matters whether we conclude the conduct many years ago tells us anything about his present views. What has been his record for the last 35 years? Your thoughts?
I would agree with that to some degree. Yeah, I mean, what have you done for me lately? Kind of thing with politicians, especially. I mean, I think it's what is their record, and what are they doing in office? And I don't know that he can survive this, but he might be able to. It's possible. But the problem with him is he keeps stepping in. He keeps making mistakes as he tries to extricate himself from the problem. And that's where, it's a big problem for Virginia, as you pointed out. I mean, especially the Democratic Party there. I don't know how.
Aside, it doesn't really get to this issue.
Right.
But the calls for his head have been muted by problems with the next two officials in line.
Sure.
Well, the trust element is still there, though. And what's interesting about that is that it's always going to be this sort of cloud because of how it's handled, but the fact that he did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd really like to hear, what people say when they decide they're going to do that, that you're going to put blackface on. And typically that's done for entertainment, which is its history. Yeah. It was done for entertainment and a way of mocking and belittling. There was nothing flattering. Even when T.D. Rice did it the very first time, he saw a slave and decided he was going to dress up like a slave and be silly. And that became a whole entertainment for decades of white men, a lot of Irish white men, dancing and being silly and mocking supposed black people in terms of language. There's a lot of D's and does, the kind of stuff you get out of Uncle Remus. That's the tradition there. So, when you talk about comedians, as we talked about between the segments there, you call it what you want. It's still black and brown face, though. And it's there for an entertainment. There's
I guess
nothing complicated. Mm. And we're still looking at the ways in which race relations are still strained. And much of the same things that existed then in terms of attitudes toward dehumanizing, animalizing, being fearful of, not being very educated, not being very attractive, those attitudes still persist. That's what the issue is. As I see it.
Well, as you know, a lot of African-American comedians go into this area, maybe not necessarily a blackface, but they talk about race relations and sometimes with language that people might consider vulgar or you know, not offensive, but problematic, as you say. And so I guess if you create a taboo that you can never make fun of this taboo. Then I think that becomes a problem. You've like erected this something that you can never discuss or never, you know. So I think that's – I don't know I want to put those strictures on people because, we had a comedian like Richard Pryor, obviously, you know. I mean, but, look at the title. I won't repeat them, but the titles of his LPs, you know.
But now we seem like we're talking about apples and oranges now. Because we're talking about those who are black, who are doing things that are in-group things versus those who are on the outside.
But Richard Pryor was performing before integrated audiences.
Correct. But Richard Pryor also, once he went to Mecca, said that he was never going to use that word again.
But he did. He kind of went back on that, if I remember correctly.
Are we talking N-word here?
We're talking about the N-word. Okay. But my sense, again, is that, you know, there's no monolithic way of looking at groups and First of all, the N-word and blackface have very specific histories, and I personally challenge those black people who use it, the hip-hop folks who are using it and claiming that they're making it a term of endearment. That's historically impossible.
And I think, to me, what that does, and I was going to actually raise that as a question, is I think what they do is they make it very difficult to say, listen, this is out of bounds, this is sanctioned. And at a very minimum, I say two groups of white people will hear that. One is the people who want an excuse to use it. You know, the people who are more racist will take that as license. And there will be some who will be just less aware who will get confused by that.
Well, I don't think white people are confused. I work with high school students and third graders, and they're not confused. Sometimes black
not
people
confused
are confused
by
about
they,
the
when,
use of the word.
When they hear a rapper using it and saying that doesn't communicate that that's okay, that's not a verboten word.
Well, first of all rappers don't use it.
Right. They
also do all kinds of other things that are misogynistic and homophobic. So the question is, what do we choose to use and not use? Mm-hmm. So there's a
How
whole
about none of the above.
Well, I would say we should be more mindful of our use of any word that can be disparaging. And until someone can show me that word is not equally laced with all the horror and violence that is associated with race relations in this country, then I don't know that it's okay for anyone to use it in a non-historical context. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of education on multiple sides, but I wouldn't necessarily say, you know, because the question that I've had about the blackface, you know, that one person says, oh, I know about white chicks. Why is that not as problematic? Well, first of all, there's not a tradition of that. And there is still a power dynamic when we talk about being in this country where whiteness, not necessarily every white person, there is a system that privileges those who are white, period.
Yeah, I think it's important, obviously, to recognize the history of words and, you know, and the things like blackface and how insulting they can be. You know, the problem is that if you want to diffuse things, people aren't monolithic, races aren't monolithic, then why should we have monolithic rules that apply to, you know, a word or, you know, I'm not saying that people should be, you know, it's like you shouldn't feel some inhibition about using the word. But I think that I was thinking, you know, we're talking about comedians and I was thinking of Lenny Bruce. And Lenny Bruce had, he wasn't a big part of his shtick, but he had a couple of jokes, very specific jokes that used the N-word. And one of them was about Lyndon Johnson, who was known to use the N-word. And he
a lot.
Even though, you know, Lyndon Johnson did great things for civil rights, so you could also there's a give and take there. But Lenny Bruce, his whole thing was the his imitation of someone teaching his Lyndon Johnson's advisors teaching him how to say Negro, which was the appropriate term at the time for African Americans. Now, he's not using that in a derogatory way. He is actually attacking racism. And if you say, well, a white person can never use this word, I don't know. I think that becomes problematic.
Well, I don't recall saying that a white person could never use it. In fact, I said there are black people who need to rethink.
Some have. You haven't.
Well, so I didn't say that.
But you said earlier you were saying you can't. I mean, like, well, which is it? Can a white person use that word?
Well, see, I think you're being reductive now when you talk. It feels like a checklist about who can use it and who can't. What I'm saying is that if the word is being used in a historical context, if you're trying to do a play, if you're trying to represent American slavery. But what I said is that black people are just as confused about the use of this word also. I said all we're asking people to do is to think critically, whether it's a word that is racially problematic or sexist or homophobic or cisgender or any of those words. Mm. We should be cognizant of those. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I don't want to have a checklist because that's what happens.
I don't want that either.
People want checklists. Well, can I say it? Can I not say it? And I'm saying, well, of course you can say it. You're not going to be arrested saying it, but there will be social consequences. And part of that is the histories that we have inherited but didn't create.
But context is a big part of this. And I'll give you an example. I mean, you've probably been to Asia. I mean, when I visited Japan the first time, what shocked me was the use of the swastika. In the Buddhist temples, and
which has no relation whatsoever to the
exactly.
Nazi.
Of course, the swastika predates, but I mean, to use it in the Western context would be impossible. But in an Asian context, it's the footprint of the Buddha. You know, and represent. So what
we're talking about what's happening in terms of American race relations, though, because others outside would also say that. They say, well, I listen to hip hop music, so therefore I'm going to use it. And I'm saying, well, first of all hip hop music doesn't use it. And I'm just asking people to think critically about what comes out of their mouth. Are we always imitating what we hear?
The point about that, I mean, you're an intellectual, okay, and we're dealing with a population that doesn't always think deeply about these issues. And I wonder if, I mean, I would have a problem with banning it from literature for reasons that we could go into it. But to the general population, there's a lot of folks who don't get nuance.
But this is not about nuance, though. I have not found anybody who's confused about that word, and I've been talking about this for over 10 years now. There are no white people who are confused. What happens is that white people don't want to be told that there are words that they shouldn't use. Mm-hmm. But I'd also say that about black people if it's not being used in a historical context. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
We'll pick that up in a final segment when we return in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back with Professor Neil Lester and Stephen Levins, journalist. One of the things that in terms of the Virginia situation in particular, I think that one can raise as an objection to too heavy a sanction for past behavior is look at the folks that are still out there engaging in equally bad behavior currently. Stephen King, congressman, our own representative, Representative Stringer, quote, and this is contemporary. African Americans and other racial groups don't blend in after coming to the United States. Unlike other members of European descent, they always look different. There aren't enough white kids to go around in public schools. These statements are contemporaneous. They are there's no walk back. They're beliefs currently expressed. When there are elected officials who are more contemporaneously upfront about that, are we missing the point by focusing attention on behavior that's decades old?
I don't know. I actually think that this kind of discussion is helpful because we should have it more often.
I'm not saying discussion. I'm saying, you know, kind of political capital punishment must resign.
Well, yeah. Oh, you mean as far as should that be applied? Yeah, it's not applied equally.
Yeah, I'm saying, yeah, that's sort of the sort of equal standard thing. We've got past behavior. We got why are we worried as not worried? I have no problem worried about not. Why are it does it make sense to argue for political capital punishment for people for past behavior when there are plenty of examples of people whose current behavior would seem to warrant the same treatment?
But they're being challenged also. Mm-hmm. The comments are being challenged. Yeah. I guess I'm less interested in the punishment than the fact that we understand what the nature of the crime has been, mm-hmm. if we're going to call it that. And that's what's clear from this discussion is that we don't all necessarily agree or understand what the nature of the crime is. Mm-hmm. If we don't understand that the past is the present and how people are being treated today just based on the social mm-hmm. construction we call race, mm-hmm. then there's no way to understand mm-hmm. that. And what I keep hearing from people, not necessarily here, is this sense of, well, how do we get past this? And, oh, this happened way in the past. But there is every reason to believe that what we are experiencing in the present is intimately connected to how people have been treated in the past and continue to be treated.
I totally agree. I totally agree because it was not necessarily a mistake, but when Obama was first elected, there was this, oh, well, we're in a post-racial society, which I thought was a little ridiculous.
Well, and clearly provoked a reaction, brought stuff out of the woodwork that was a lot more hidden.
Been called a white lash, and I think for good reason. I think that, Trump's rise is related in some ways in how people reacted to Obama, But my point is that I don't think it's possible to get to that post-racial thing. There's too much history involved, like hundreds of years of history. And we were talking about the South and that we're both from the South. And you're reminded of that every day. As the professor just – you paraphrased Faulkner's famous quote that the past isn't past. It's always with us, as you pointed out. And it's a very good point. It is always with us. And we have to be cognizant of it. We can't escape it. It's like a nightmare you can't awake from.
Well, we also inherit it. There's a line from Amir Baraka's play Dutchman from 1964. It says, let's pretend we have no histories. And the reality is that we inherit these histories, both racially, along gender lines. There are all kinds of ways that we inherit the history. So to acknowledge that history, I hear people saying now, can't we just leave that in the past? And why are we always talking? In fact,
you hear that a lot. Yeah.
Yes. What I hear about that mostly from are people who don't necessarily look like me, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's very telling. Because what I also hear is that there's a lot of efforts to apologize for the behavior when somebody has stepped into something that they shouldn't have stepped in. And they start saying, oh, well, this happened years ago. Mm-hmm. Let's look at what he's doing now. Instead of acknowledging and focusing on what he has done and his behavior, there is no statute of limitations
talking about
why
that's a problem.
That's what people will say. You mentioned this when we had our first conversation. Should there be some sort of period blocked off and said, well, we're not going to go past this in order to talk about or hold people accountable? And I keep saying that those isms are not blocked off in neat time periods so that what one has done in the past stays with them. And again, this particular governor can continue to evolve and understand white privilege and all these other ways in which he has benefited and not been called on for his actions, but he'll have to do it in a different role.
Well, if he resigns and he's not governor, that's going to be a very private enlightenment because nobody's going to pay attention anymore.
Well,
because if he resigns, he becomes a non-person.
Right. Well, but we also said, he's not going to be killed. There's no criminal activity he's engaged in.
No, he's a doctor. He's not going to go.
I would be reluctant about going to him as my doctor, though. No matter how much stuff he's done for black people in Virginia.
Let me talk about erasing.
I see your point. He was a pediatrician, neurosurgeon or something.
Children or grandchildren.
No, I see. Yeah, your
point.
Because
the trust has been gone.
Right. No, I agree.
And it's hard to rebuild that.
Well, that's also.
I want to introduce you one last thought and get you to react to because we're getting near the end. What about the distinction between those people who slip up, they say a wrong word did this thing once, and other people who may harbor far worse attitudes, but were just more careful about concealing it?
What's your question? Because I don't know how you see those. In fact, there's something called, you know, intentional fallacy. Mm-hmm. You know, people are always talking about, oh, I didn't intend this or I didn't mean that. Well, here's my example. And it may not work. You know, mm-hmm. if I'm driving through and I run a red light, which I don't do, and I hit somebody, mm-hmm. I didn't really intend to hit somebody. I didn't really intend to read the record, but the impact is the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I can't see what's inside your head, and we have things called unconscious biases that we can't even see. So I don't really know what to do when people start talking about, I didn't mean to do it. I can tell you what the impact of that has been, whether you meant to or not.
Yeah. No, I also don't want to say that, like you said, people evolve on their own time, and that's true. He's a public figure, so he's held to a different standard. But for the ordinary person, I think we should allow for the possibility that people can change. And I think people can change. Right. I think people's views can change.
Absolutely.
And part of that is
if they can't, we're in a lot of
trouble. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
But again, on your own time, you can do that.
Yeah. No, I don't.
And, you don't need to be in a public office trying
to evolve. Let's put it this way.
In that way.
There is a political dimension to what he did and then a right. personal dimension.
Right.
I don't totally buy this whole thing about he didn't, you know, it was a different time. I agree with you about that because
it wasn't that far.
No.
It wasn't 1946.
No,
wasn't a teenager.
Yeah, 1980.
He was a grown man.
Well, yes. Yeah, 1984. I mean, I may have still been in high school getting ready to go to college, but I had enough sense that would have been a complete taboo. And now I would never have even gone. So I think most people at that time would have thought that was completely taboo. Right. Now, do people make jokes about things? You know, the 70s. As an era, was a little more permissive, though. You have to admit that. I don't think that taboo has ever changed. It's always been there.
Correct. Correct.
Well, I hope we've enlightened a bit.
Thank you very much.
Neil Lester, thank you for being here. Thank you, Steve Lemons, both first times. Hope you can both come back at some future time. We can continue this or another discussion.
Thank you.
Think Tank. We'll see you next week.
Sirens call them all.